Salut, ici Matt Track, vous écoutez CKUT.
What's the matter? Is everything all right? That's okay. I've got just the right thing for you. CKUT 90.3 FM.
Okay, I gotta let you go. I have to get my Lake Magog vaccine.
Your Lake Magog vaccine?
Yeah, you know, I'm really looking forward to having the whole family to the cottage for my annual cookout.
Smart move. I'm gonna ask for the Montreal vaccine. I miss those last-minute get-togethers with my buddies.
Nice. Well, I gotta run. I don't think it protects against lateness.
Each vaccination brings us closer to these moments. Follow the vaccination sequence planned for your area and book an appointment at quebec.ca/COVID-vaccine. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
The People's Sound is calling. The Swanee Perry Popolo Music Festival is back and online with free jazz, noise, punk, new music, spoken word, electronic, avant-rock, sound art, and dance parties. Over 60 artists performing from Montreal, Chicago, Philadelphia, Sioux Lookout, Toronto, Mexico City, Brussels, Berlin, Tehran, Kampala, and Nairobi. Heed the call between June 3rd and 21st at swanneeperrypopolo.org.
Good evening and welcome to Older Women Live on CKUT at 90.3 FM. Our show is on the air the second Wednesday of every month from 6 until 7, and we're a feminist radio show produced by a small collective of older women. My name is Rosemary Walling. Today we're going to be talking about an issue of supreme importance. Nuclear weapons are the ultimate expression of the patriarchy, and that's our topic for tonight, nuclear weapons. In 1982, the National Film Board of Canada produced a 26-minute documentary film in which an Australian paediatrician, Dr. Helen Caldicott, described what would happen in the event of a nuclear war. She was talking to a group of young college students in the States. This film was sensational. It was called If You Love This Planet, and you can find it on YouTube. Tonight, we're lucky enough to have as our Zoom guest, Judy Berlin, a local woman who for years has been a member of Échec à la Guerre, a coalition of groups trying to raise awareness of the dangers of nuclear war and the complicity of the Canadian government in supporting the existence of nuclear weapons.
It would gouge out a crater half a mile wide and 300 feet deep so that everything in that volume would be converted to radioactive fallout, be pulverized, millions of tons of rock injected into the stratosphere and troposphere where it would descend as radioactive fallout. Every person out to a radius of 6 miles from the epicenter would be vaporized, just turn into gas, and most buildings. Out to a radius of 20 miles from the center, most persons would be dead or lethally injured. And when I say lethally injured, I mean tens of thousands of cases of the most severe burns. A single burn takes about 3 to 6 months to treat, requiring hundreds of units of fresh frozen plasma and blood, 24-hour intensive care nursing, operations every couple of days for months, and then often the patients die. There are only 2,000 acute burn beds in the whole of the United States. There would be shocking injuries, you see, as people are sucked out of buildings and thrown against other buildings. Buildings disintegrate and concrete and steel are thrown around like matchsticks. Millions of shards of flying glass as windows disintegrate. People decapitated, organ injuries, ruptured lungs, compound fractures. That compound fracture means the bone sticking out of the skin, and so on. What was left of the buildings would be lying in what was left of the streets. If you looked at the blast or the flash from 40 miles away, just glanced at it, you'd be instantly blinded as the flash burnt the retina or the back of the eye. It would ignite everything that was inflammable within an area of 3,000 square miles. So everything would burn and the fires would coalesce, sucking the air in with hurricane force winds to the center of the explosion. And if you made it to a fallout shelter in that 20 minutes to half an hour's time, you would not survive because you would be pressure cooked and or asphyxiated as the fires used up all the oxygen. In the Dresden firestorms, the people who made it to the shelters all died. They asphyxiated.
We'll be right back. Judy Berlin, can you tell us what the doomsday clock is?
Doomsday clock is very interesting. It was set up by the group of scientists called the atomic scientists. They put out the bulletin of the atomic scientists. It started in 1947, just after the end of World War II, a couple of years. And it's a kind of a metaphor, really, for threats to humanity, threats that derive from technological and scientific developments, our own technological and scientific work, if you like, or they say progress. I don't think it's progress because it's all very threatening and very destructive. They set the hands on the clock moving towards midnight. Midnight represents the likelihood of a absolutely catastrophic development because of what we are doing. And the two things they've now set the clock in January of 2020, where it remains at 100 seconds to midnight, which is the closest it's ever been, even during the Cold War. In 1947 at 7 minutes to midnight, and it's now got to 100 seconds to midnight because of the two threats they consider that really put us in terrible peril and threaten life on Earth as we know it, really. And these are, of course, global warming and nuclear weapons or nuclear period than just nuclear technology, whether weapons existing, whether they're ever used or not. The fact that they're there is very perilous because they can easily be an accident with one of them. The way we've had accidents with the nuclear reactors, we can have an accident with the nuclear.
Exactly.
Thousands of nuclear weapons still in the world.
I think it's also important to say that this group of scientists are considered the leading experts on extinction, on human extinction.
Right. That's right.
Any old little scientists.
No, that's right.
So why has it moved to 100 seconds from its 7 minutes in 1947?
Because of human-made situations. I mean, it's we who create the conditions for global warming that are the most disastrous. We know that by our use of fossil fuels, principally. And it's we that decided to make and maintain nuclear arsenals. And we can, the solution is, as famous Dr. Helen Caldicott has said, we are living on a terminally ill planet, in medical terms. And these are the two diseases, if you want, or terminal diseases we're suffering from, global and nuclear weapons. And both of them it's up to us to deal with. And we have the solutions. We know what we have to do. It's a matter of doing it. It's the solution to the nuclear threat is really fairly straightforward. We have to decommission and dismantle all these weapons. And it's quite doable. There is one country, people are surprised, they don't know this. There's one country that has done it, that did develop nuclear weapons, made a few, and then decided they would put that all away. They were not going to go on with it, and they got rid of them. And most people have no idea that country was South Africa.
Wow. Yes. I think also there's a third threat, and that is the threat of the silence around these two issues, the issues of nuclear weapons and the issues of climate change. People don't seem to worry about it. And then there's also our prime...
Well, they're worried about global warming at this point. I think they are worried about global warming, don't you?
Well, if you read the media, the straight media, Judy, I'm sure you agree with me, that there's a lot of celebrity information in it, and there's very little on nuclear weapons and climate change. You know, you look at the front page of the New York Times, and there's very, very little information on that. The Republican Party or whatever.
Yeah, no, that's right. The nuclear, I mean, what was the famous Dr. Strangelove movie, How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb? I don't think people love the bomb, but I do think they've learned to stop worrying about it, and I don't know why, because the threat they pose is greater now than ever, because the ones that have, they go on, the science, as you say, goes on developing newer and bigger and more destructive. We all know that they're just horrendously destructive, these nuclear weapons. Some people say they shouldn't even be called weapons, because in the normal sense, ordinary weapons of war are bad enough, and they kill hundreds of people and wound them and so on. But these kill hundreds of thousands in one instant and incinerate whole city cores and everybody who lives in them and all the built. I mean, they're just horrendously more destructive than anything we've ever had before. And then there's the radiation that gets released and persists in the air, soil, and water for decades, and in some cases, thousands of years. And it's insanity to be going on with these technologies. Just insanity.
So if you could imagine one nuclear war, bomb dropping, say, on, I don't know, a city, what would the effects of that be? It wouldn't just stay in that city, would it?
Oh, no, doesn't it? It's horrendous. As a matter of fact, the physicians for the prevention of nuclear war have done a paper exactly on that. I mean, the first thing that happens is there's an enormously bright flash and instant fireball. And anyone looking in that direction for up to 80 kilometers will be blinded, have their retina burned by the flash. It's so bright. If the atmospheric conditions are right and there are no mountains in between or anything, 80 kilometers away, you could be blinded by it. And the fire, it instantly incinerates everything at ground zero for quite a diameter. Everybody just vaporizes. And the buildings are all into smithereens. And then further out, there are these terribly severe burns. People's flesh gets burned and their clothing catches fire from the heat. There's this wave of heat that rolls out from it. And the blast, the force of that. I mean, there's various kinds of energy. There's the light and the heat. It's called kinetic energy. Then there's a blast, a wind force, gales, and buildings get blown off their foundations, and windows are shattered, and shards of glass and metal are flying everywhere. And if you're further out and you haven't been killed outright, you get killed by these flying debris, and picked up and hurled through the air yourself and smashed to the ground and burnt. as I said, from the heat. And of course, the hospitals are destroyed and the doctors are killed, and there's no possible medical aid. They had the descriptions of people. We have one woman living in Canada who survived. It was in Hiroshima.
Yeah, Hiroshima. She survived.
Yes, and she remembers people, you know, gasping for, begging for water. And she said they looked like phantoms. They didn't even look like human beings because the flesh was full, you know, they were all burned and bones were sticking out and before they died. It was just, it's just terrible what happens. And then there's the radiation, which goes on falling out. It'll go up and come down later as acid rain, I mean, as radioactive rain, far and wide. And the thing spreads further out and further out. And of course, it also something they didn't know at first. The ash or the soot from all these burning buildings rises up into the stratosphere and creates a great thick layer that will eventually, you know, within a few, I don't know, months, spread all around the planet, and it blocks the sunlight. And it interferes with the growing then, because you don't get enough sun with the agricultural production is greatly reduced. And if it's bad enough, that creates something called nuclear famine. And if it lasts long enough, it's called nuclear winter. People will starve to death because they won't be able to grow things. And that would be an all out war. No, it's very serious. But we don't have to have a war for there to be an accidental detonation. And that's highly likely. We've had accidents, horrible accidents with the nuclear reactors. We know Chernobyl and Three Mile Island and more recently Fukushima. When we get an accident like that with the nuclear weapons, of which, as I say, there are over 13,000 still in 9 different countries in the it's going to be make those reactor accidents look like child's play, really, because it'd be far worse. And then there's always the possibility of nuclear terrorism, as it's called. You get people who have of ill intent getting their hands on some of the raw materials and making their own nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which is, as somebody has said, we never kept anything out of the hands of people with criminal intent. So why would we think we'll keep this?
Well, I think also it's important to mention that all this that you were talking about, the horror of this, is all done with our tax dollars. It's a time when we should be using our tax dollars for other things. So I think that's also an important point. Irony of irony, our own money is being used to destroy ourselves.
Destroy, well, yeah, that's right.
Can we move on to talking a little bit about Échec à la Guerre, this group that you've been so involved with for so long, Judy?
Échec à la Guerre is not a group, it's a collective. It's called, its full name is the Collective Échec à la Guerre, because it is a coalition of. Originally, it was all member groups, and now they're also member individuals can be members. So it's groups and individuals, about 60, I think, members of Échec à la Guerre. And it's everything from, you know, the usual components of peace movement, faith-based groups, community groups, unions, professional groups of professional people of various sorts. Like the Artists for Peace and the physicians groups and so on. And it simply is, it started really, came together on the eve of the war in Iraq, the war in Iraq that started in 2003 and was organized the big marches in Montreal in February and March of 2003 to is part of a cross Canada effort to keep Canada out, stop Canada going to that war, which
it did.
Which we did not do, thank goodness. We were already at war in Afghanistan, though. But we at least didn't join that Iraq war. And then from there, it's gone on to look at, as you say, the money that goes into arms trade, the arms business, really, which is very big business, and all subsidized with our tax. So the things about the arms business is, it's highly profitable because it doesn't face any of the usual forces of the capitalist system. Whatever you think about capitalism, at least there are some things that normally are operating. People have to do a certain amount of advertising and they have a certain amount of competition. And they, you know, they are, but when you're in the arms business, you don't have to do any of that. You don't have to, you know, if you make tanks, you don't have to take an ad in Time magazine like you do if you make trucks. And so you save a lot of money there. You also don't have nearly the same level of competition, and all your business goes to governments. So it's paid for by tax dollars. Taxes buy all the arms. And your production is subsidized in the first place, also with tax dollars. So all it becomes, you know, it's a way of siphoning money out of the public purse straight into private pockets.
So why isn't there more outrage? Why aren't people up and out on the streets complaining about this?
Well, they do from time to time. They don't always realize, I guess. And also they've been brainwashed into thinking that somehow we need all this stuff to be safe, when in fact, it really is, particularly in the case of the nuclear weapons, doesn't make us safe at all. It makes us much less safe. It's a good question. I don't know why not. They don't realize it, or they, you know, why aren't they objecting to all kinds of things their taxes are used for? Then?
But I know that the job of the Échec à la guerre is to raise awareness and to wake up the population, and that you've recently, your organization has recently come out with a new pamphlet. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yes, well, it's precisely on this matter. There is, on the question of nuclear weapons again, there've been efforts worldwide in the realm of international law to try and do something about it. So we have the treaty on the non-proliferation of nuclear weapons, which came into force in 1970, so it's 50 years old now, more than. And it was a deal between the countries, I'm getting to Échec à la guerre in a minute, a deal between the countries that had nuclear weapons at the time and the ones that didn't, which was most of the world. And the deal was that the countries that did not have nuclear weapons promised not to acquire them. And the countries that had them promised to negotiate getting rid of them. And by and large, the people on the side of not acquiring them, which is called non-proliferation, have kept their side of the deal pretty much. We do have four more countries now. There were five altogether, including the South Africa, as I mentioned, now, that have acquired them. But, you know, there are nearly 200 members of the United Nations, and everybody, almost all the countries that are members of the United Nations have signed that treaty. Only four countries haven't, and those are the four new nuclear countries, which are Israel, India, Pakistan, North Korea. They have not signed the treaty on the non-proliferation of nuclear weapons. And then in the mid-90s, the World Court ruled, having been asked by the General Assembly to do so, that it was illegal to use nuclear weapons under existing international law, particularly international humanitarian law, pretty much precludes any possibility of using a nuclear weapon without violating international law. So you couldn't use, you're supposed to be getting rid of them. You couldn't use them legally, but you still could have them. And now we have, just this year in January, this new treaty on the prohibition of nuclear weapons. which says you can't even have them. It's illegal to have them in the same sense it's illegal to have biological or chemical weapons. And it's finally put nuclear weapons in that same legal and ethical basket, if you like, as biological and chemical weapons, where it should have been longer. Anyway, and that, so with the impetus of that treaty coming, having been, took 2 years to negotiate and so on, but we knew it came into force in January, Chekeleger decided it was time to get out a pamphlet on this whole issue of nuclear weapons, what they do, how many there are, who has them, and what the situation in terms of international law is regarding them, and so on, because Canada is not signing, is refusing to sign this new treaty on the prohibition of nuclear weapons.
Why?
Well, because the United States doesn't want any of its NATO allies to sign it, and they are all kowtowing. It's really quite ridiculous. NATO is an alliance of 29 countries at this point. Three of them have nuclear weapons, namely the United States, the UK, and France. And 26 members of NATO do not have nuclear weapons, and that includes Canada. And so, but for some reason, Canada, instead of teaming up with some of the other countries that don't have nuclear weapons and pushing back against the United States imposing its nuclear weapons policy on NATO, there's absolutely no requirement for people to go along with what the U.S. wants in terms of NATO's attitude towards nuclear weapons, but somehow they all do. Now, there was a time 20-odd years ago when Canada did team up with Germany and about a dozen other NATO members. They did push back against the influence of the United States in this regard and forced a kind of review of NATO's nuclear policy. The outcome wasn't what we would have wanted, but at least they didn't just cut out. Now we seem to be just, you know, being pushed around. I mean, the Prime Minister said about something else, Canadians were patient and polite, but we don't get pushed around. Well, on this, we're very much getting pushed around. And we don't need to let ourselves be, but.
So what would be the solution, do you think, to not being pushed around?
It's to simply say, sorry, we disagree. We think this is a good treaty and we're going to sign it.
So this is up to really, at the moment, this is up to Justin Trudeau and his colleagues. I mean,
absolutely.
There's a tremendous arrogance, I think, that the government has this position the government has taken in not consulting the population.
Yes, I must say the business of proper consultations and public hearings about things has gone way down. There did used to be a time when there were government had public hearings on all kinds of things. And there was an opportunity in a very structured and, structured communication channels, ways that you could, now you can write to your MP, of course,
and you really
that kind of thing. But there aren't, the government isn't actively seeking and consulting the population at all. And seeking providing, as I say, the opportunity via public hearings and committee hearings and that kind of thing. I mean, I've gone to many of them and testified on various issues in the past.
Yeah, of course.
And now they're just steaming.
They railroad things through.
Father knows best. We know what we're doing and we know what's best. And they're always telling us, if you notice in their speeches, Canadians expect us to do this. The Canadians want us. They're always telling us what we expect of them. And really, we should be telling them. I had an idea the other night. I thought, this is crazy. I forget what it was. Some other minister said, Canadians want us to do so and so. I thought, well, we'll tell you what we want. Thank you very much. Why don't we sit down, all of us, and these various people who work on various issues, and write our own mandate letters for the ministers So Prime Minister writes these mandate letters, and if you read them, they're pretty hollow things. And I thought, well, why don't we, the citizens, get together and write mandate letters and say, all right, minister of this and that, here's what we want you to do. And I think we should.
Well, I think sadly, you know, there's an arms buildup at the moment. There are these threats of going to war with countries like China. We're being told all kinds of erroneous information.
China into the new enemy, that's right.
The new enemy. You know, how can, what can people do? Where can they go for real information? Because I think this is a huge issue, that there's no real information available, that's easily available. So this is to the government's advantage, that the population is silent, confused, that we don't quite know what to see, think. Meanwhile, they are there building these weapons, selling them, trading, or whatever.
Yeah, they do. They use the weapons trading and making and trading as a kind of an economic engine. They deliberately spread it around in different provinces so that everybody gets a bit of the business and everybody will think it's a good idea. I don't know what we can do. I mean, other than, as you say, be better informed. There's this Pilger film you were recommending about the new war with China. What's the title?
It's called The Coming War with China, and it's by John Pilger, P-I-L-G-E-R, who is a very well-known and very well-established Australian journalist who's been doing this work for, at least 50 years, if not more. Can we talk a little bit about the connection between nuclear war and climate change?
Well, as I said, the two threats that the doomsday hands on have caused, the hands on the doomsday clock to be set at 100 seconds to midnight, considered equal threats by the atomic scientists. As we said at the beginning, they're both things. The peril they pose is entirely created by us. And so we have to solve them, and we know what we have to do. I mean, when it comes to the link is really there, that they are both the result of our technology and our science, and they're equal existential threats, as they're often called, that we have to deal with together, really, because there isn't time to do one and then the other, or to do them separately. We really should be tackling them both. There's a rather sick joke that's sometimes made is the nuclear winter that I described would happen. There were ever a nuclear war would certainly solve global warming. I mean, we'd freeze, we'd starve to death because we didn't have enough sunlight. But that's hardly the way we want to solve either.
But we know that a lot of young people particularly are really concerned about...
We need to decommission and dismantle...
We know that young people particularly are really concerned about climate change.
Yes.
I'm wondering how we could add the
nuclear...
Yes.
Because they don't... it's very hard to know, isn't it? Because they don't... As you say, it's not in the news. The politicians aren't talking about it. How are they to... You can tell people, but if they don't feel it viscerally... And it's hard to know why. I mean, during the Cold War, people were very, very concerned because they did think that the Cold War might turn into a nuclear war. They were afraid of that. But they're not, as I say, the subtitle of Dr. Strangelove movie is probably true. People are not worrying about it anymore, apparently. And I don't know why not, but I think the new generation just haven't grown up with it. It's there, but it's there very much in the background.
I mean, for our generation, Judy, you will remember this. You know, when we were 18, 19, 20, when we were young, We were out there all the time trying to ban the bomb. I've still got all my buttons from that period.
That's right. Oh, yeah, absolutely. But it was during the Cold War, that's the thing. And we did think that maybe there was going to be Soviet-U.S. nuclear war. That was a very, very real possibility in everybody's minds. And I think they now think that no one's deliberately going to use them, which is why I say doesn't have to be a deliberate use for there to be the catastrophe, because mm-hmm. all of this is a detonation through technological failure or human error of some kind. We've come very close in the past in all kinds of ways. They have faulty computer chips, they get false warnings, and almost people think they're under attack. There was one time when the Americans thought the Soviets were about to attack. I forget what had caused that false warning. Before, they were literally on the verge of retaliating when somebody woke up and realized it was unlikely that they were about to be attacked by the Soviet Union, because the leader of the Soviet Union, Nikita Khrushchev, at that very moment was in New York City leading a Soviet delegation to the United Nations. So somebody said, hey, wait a minute, I think if the leader's here in New York, they're not liable to be about to bomb us. So they decided to check and discovered that it was a false alarm. But they're very faulty alarm systems. I mean, you know, the Cuban Missile Crisis, some people still remember that. That came very close then to having nuclear war, but that would have been deliberate. But the accidental ones are quite likely, as I say, or nuclear terrorism is very real possibility. I mean, imagine if the people who did 9/11 had had nuclear weapons rather than civilian airplanes to fly into those buildings. Where would we be?
If people want more information on this, rather on this very, very grim but very serious topic, can you suggest any films or videos, books?
Well, there's quite a lot, and the Shekhar Lagarre is coming out with this pamphlet. It's now available in French in the PDF form, and it will be translated into English in the coming weeks. I don't know exactly the deadline. And there will be printed versions as well, although with the kinds of places we normally would distribute it aren't, you know, the gatherings aren't happening yet. But as we come out of COVID, go to the Shekhar Lagarre reading articles, books, and films on the subject. So there is quite a lot of information available, actually. And that is just Shekhar Lagarre, Shekhar Lagarre, I guess it's .org. I had the thing here a minute ago. So they're looking for...
Okay, so if people go to the Shekhar Lagarre website, can find information. They can find the pamphlet in French at the moment. And maybe there's other information.
That's right. And the reading list has a lot of English material on it, because there's more available in English than there is in French, actually, which is one of the reasons they want to do the pamphlet.
Shekhar Lagarre.org.
The mentality, which I don't think has changed, the mentality of the people who are planning all this and producing them, but it's very good at telling you what the effects of a nuclear detonation is, what a nuclear bomb does. She's very graphic in describing it. And
yes,
we're living on a terminally ill planet.
And a patriarchal one at that.
Sorry?
A patriarchal planet at that.
Yes, absolutely. And the new book out by Ray Atchison, who works with the NGO at the UN who tracks this stuff very closely, is called Reaching Critical Will, referring, of course, to the political will we need to get rid of these things. And Ray Atchison, who's a figure there, has just come out with a new book, links to patriarchy, to all this. It's definitely is a, and so does Helen Caldicott. That's right. It's a matter of, well, she likens it to kids playing in the playground and saying, I've got a, you know, bigger truck than you have, kind of thing. And that's the problem, I think, with nuclear weapons in the hands of the politicians. They just, they're kind of the biggest stick. That's all it is. They are the biggest stick, and everybody wants to have the biggest stick. It's very cavemanish, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very primitive indeed.
Yeah.
Well, the video that I would definitely recommend is the one that we've already mentioned, The Coming War with China, which John Pilger made, I think, in 2016-17. So it's fairly recent. And also, yes. I think that if we're reading the papers at the moment, we know about these war games that are happening as we speak in the South China Sea, which Canada is also participating in, sending lots of ships.
And also there's this new space force that the U.S. is adding to its military, a new arm of its military, and the space that will eventually have nuclear weapons stationed in space if it really goes ahead, so that they'll be able to nuke us from outer space at any point. You know, there used to be a thing called Vision for 2020. That was, we've gone past 2020 now, but that proposed all kinds of space-based stuff connected to nuclear weapons.
Exactly.
It's insanity. And the solution, we know what the solution is. We have technologically, there's not a problem to decommissioning and dismantling those weapons and verifying that it's been properly done under international control and inspection and all that. It's a matter of the political will to get on with it. That's what's lacking. And that's where we come in. I mean, without a mass movement, that's the problem. So you say, how can we get people to get up in arms about this, no pun intended. But unless there is a mass movement, I don't think the politicians are going to just wake up one day and say, what fools we've been. We must do something about this.
Highly unlikely, highly unlikely. Yes, we're just going to have to plead to the younger generation. It's in your interest to get out there on the streets and
when you talk about global warming, talk about nuclear weapons in the same vein. We want to cure global warming and we want to get rid of nuclear weapons.
Well,
in
thank
order
you very
to
much, Judy, for talking to us today. And we'll meet again on the picket line, I'm sure. Do you have any final words?
We will.
So we're now still 100 seconds to midnight. Wow.
Well, it's getting more crucial. I guess that's where we haven't talked about the fact that the so-called modernization of the nuclear arsenals, but they go on. Not only are they not abiding by international law and negotiating nuclear disarmament as they're supposed to be and are committed to doing, but they are in fact going in the opposite direction. They are making more, they are making new generations of even more destructive nuclear weapons. As Helen Caldicott says in her film, If You Love This Planet, how many times over do you have to kill every single human being? I mean, we're capable now of killing everybody many times over.
Yeah, and killing all life. It's killing life as well, isn't it? All the animals, all the plants, all trees, forests, everything.
No, of course. Oh, yeah. Everything. Yeah. Life on Earth as we know it.
Life on Earth as we know it. Yes, yes, yes. So, well, thank you very much anyway for talking.
So, fuck you, Debbie. Always come at me from a different angle. Make me think I don't understand how I'm feeling to the feeling that I get out of hand. Visible. Prepared.
swim again. Holy water. This is a prayer for love, 'cause I'm not sleeping. Thank you.
welcome to Amandla here on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. This is your 1 hour African current affairs show that we bring you every week. And I'm sitting here virtually with Doug, and the focus today is on Rwanda. Doug, take it away.
Well, good evening, Gwen, and good evening, listeners of Amandla. It's Rwanda. Is back on our agenda today, tonight. We've got a new book out by Michel Orang, and it's called Do Not Disturb. It's about an African regime that's gone bad. And she looks at the murder of Patrick Karegeya, an old, a childhood friend of Paul Kagame, the president of Rwanda, and how they came to power together and how he fell out of power and eventually was murdered. And I was so impressed by the interview I heard her doing on the Africa Report's Talking Africa podcast that I've pretty well made the whole show that. The Africa podcast is more than an hour, 15 minutes long. So we've had to clip out some elements of it. You can go there to Africa Report's Talking Africa podcast to get the whole thing. But I think we've given you a fairly extensive look at